Consider a mother who schedules a comprehensive evaluation for her 13-year-old daughter. She arrives with a clear hypothesis. Her daughter has ADHD. She describes concentration problems, inconsistent academic performance, intermittent panic attacks tied to schoolwork, sleep difficulty, fidgeting, restlessness, and irritability. She is confident, specific, and well-researched. She also attended an Ivy League institution, holds a demanding corporate position, and has high expectations for her daughter's academic trajectory. She wants a diagnosis that explains what is happening and a path to accommodations and medication to support enrollment in honors coursework during high school. She is not, at this moment, asking for anything other than confirmation of what she already believes. This is not an unusual presentation. It is, however, a clinically complex one, and it illustrates why motivational interviewing, MI, cannot always be cordoned off as its own treatment modality, something deployed only before or instead of other interventions. For many clients and families, MI needs to be threaded through the entire clinical encounter, assessment, feedback, treatment planning, and the ongoing work of therapy itself. A brief review of MI principles. MI was originally developed in the 1980s as a response to confrontational models of addiction treatment. Its foundational premise, that ambivalence about change is normal, not pathological, represented a meaningful departure from the assumption that resistance indicated a character flaw or treatment failure. Over subsequent decades, MI migrated far beyond its origins, becoming a transdiagnostic tool compatible with a wide range of evidence-based interventions, including cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT. Its core structure rests on four principles: express empathy, develop discrepancy, roll with resistance, and support self-efficacy. In practice, these unfold through specific skills summarized as open questions, affirmations, reflective listening, and summarizing, ORs, which together can create a conversational environment in which people feel heard rather than directed and begin to articulate their own reasons for change. The clinician's role is collaborative rather than prescriptive. Change talk is the language in which the client expresses desire, ability, reason, or commitment to change, and is actively elicited and reinforced. When integrated with CBT for anxiety disorders, MI produces meaningfully better outcomes than CBT alone. A meta-analysis of 12 clinical trials found a moderate effect size favoring combined MI-CBT over CBT alone, with effects appearing across GAD, OCD, and PTSD, regardless of how many MI sessions were provided. This matters for what follows. MI is not a warm-up to treatment. It can be a powerful component of intervention that enhances engagement with treatment, and it can function across modalities and across time. The case. The case described here is a composite of clinical presentations seen in practice and does not represent any particular individual. The 13-year-old at the center of this case was, by external measure, thriving. She earned straight A's, participated in extracurricular activities, and was described by teachers as conscientious and well-liked. Her mother's concerns centered on what was happening beneath that performance. The daughter worked for hours on assignments that should have taken 30 minutes, became visibly dysregulated around tests, couldn't fall asleep before school nights that had presentations, and had begun avoiding social interactions. Freezing in unfamiliar adults that addressed her directly or when she was expected to speak in group settings. Comprehensive evaluation did not support an ADHD diagnosis. Instead, the picture that emerged was one of generalized anxiety disorder, GAD, and social anxiety disorder, SAD. The daughter's concentration difficulties were state-dependent. They appeared under conditions of high perceived pressure and dissipated in low-stakes environments. Her fidgeting and restlessness reflected sympathetic activation, not inattention. her prolonged homework time was driven by perfectionism and perseveration, not disorganization. She had difficulty making decisions, locked up when she felt evaluated, and experienced panic in performance contexts. These occurred not because of executive dysfunction, but because her nervous system was chronically mobilized for threat. One significant contextual factor was the pressure emanating from home. The mother communicated with genuine love and equally genuine intensity that academic excellence was the family standard. The daughter internalized this value. She wanted to make her mother proud and experienced that motivation not as fuel, but as weight. When clinicians met with the daughter alone to share the diagnostic impressions, she was visibly relieved. She had worried something was wrong with her brain. The anxiety diagnosis made sense to her. She was ready to start treatment. When clinicians shared the same impressions with the mother, the response was different. She was not persuaded. She had come in expecting an ADHD diagnosis, and she was not prepared to set that expectation aside. She thanked the team, said she would be seeking a second opinion, and left. MI during feedback, meeting disagreement without confrontation. The feedback session is an underappreciated clinical moment. Clinicians typically approach it as information transfer. We have the data, we share the data, we explain the implications. But for many families, the feedback session is emotionally loaded in ways that precede anything the clinician says. Expectations have been built. Stories have been told internally and externally. The diagnosis the family came in hoping for has already, in some ways, been partially adopted. In this case, the mother was not simply uninformed. She had done her research. She was describing real symptoms. And she had a framework, ADHD, that organized those symptoms into something actionable and, importantly, neurobiological. A thing that happened to her daughter outside of her control, not a thing she had contributed to through well-intentioned pressure. To let go of that framework meant entertaining other explanations, and some of those explanations might implicate the environment at home. MI principles shaped how the feedback was delivered, rather than presenting the anxiety diagnosis as the correction of a mistaken belief. Clinicians reflected back what the mother had observed because she had observed real things. Concentration difficulties were real. Restlessness was real. The panic attacks were real. The approach validated her observations first, then offered a different account of their origin. These were symptoms the anxious nervous system produces when it is chronically under load. And anxiety of that degree can look, from the outside, very much like ADHD. The clinicians also held space for the mother's uncertainty without trying to resolve it immediately. They did not push. They reflected her ambivalence, stating, "You're not sure this fully captures what you're seeing," and invited her to ask questions rather than accept or reject. Even so, she left unconvinced. That was her right. And critically, it was not a clinical failure. MI does not guarantee movement. It creates conditions in which movement becomes more possible. Returning, the role of ambivalence. Several months later, the mother called back. A second evaluation had reached conclusions largely consistent with the first. She was now requesting therapy services for her daughter. Her position had shifted, but only partially. She acknowledged that CBT and exposure therapy might address some of what was happening. She was not prepared to say ADHD was off the table. She was, in MI terms, ambivalent, which is a clinically valuable place to be. Ambivalence is not resistance. It is the coexistence of competing motivations, and it is workable. Clinicians accepted that ambivalence without trying to collapse it prematurely. The framing used with the mother in early sessions was explicitly inclusive. Whatever is driving this, the skills we're building are the right ones. If it's anxiety, we're treating the core problem. If there's something else layered in, these tools will still help. That framing met her where she was and gave her permission to engage without requiring her to formally abandon a prior belief. Am I within the treatment structure? Individual therapy with the daughter proceeded through CBT and exposure-based intervention. She was a strong participant. She understood the model quickly, completed between-session practice, and began making meaningful contact with situations she had been avoiding. The gains were real. The treatment team made a structural decision that proved important. They invited the mother to join the final 15 minutes of every session. The purpose was transparency: to review what her daughter had worked on, discuss how to support skill practice at home, and allow the daughter to demonstrate what she was learning. These were not family therapy sessions. They were brief, structured, and daughter-led. But they created a recurring point of contact with the mother that made MI possible and allowed the clinician to reinforce assertiveness strategies the daughter learned in treatment. In those 15-minute windows, clinicians were not delivering psychoeducation so much as reflecting, reframing, and reinforcing. When the mother described her daughter's week, clinicians listened for change talk and reflected it back. When the mother expressed frustration that progress wasn't moving faster, clinicians acknowledged the frustration and explored what she was hoping for. When she described her own academic history and what it had meant for her life, clinicians did not correct or challenge. They asked questions that invited her to apply that same reflection to her daughter's experience. What had pressure felt like for her at 13? What had she needed then? These conversations were not tidy or linear. Insight in the context of parenting rarely is. But over weeks and months, something shifted. The mother began to notice the relationship between her expectations and her daughter's symptom severity. She started describing instances where she had pulled back on pressure and seen her daughter relax. She began framing the goal of treatment differently, not as making her daughter more capable of handling high pressure, but as reducing the pressure so her daughter's capability could actually emerge. She eventually articulated, unprompted, that her daughter's straight A's had not come without cost, that the cost might be the presenting problem, that she was not sure she wanted to keep paying that price. That was change talk. Clinicians reflected it, affirmed it, and let it sit. What this case illustrates: MI is often taught as a pre-treatment intervention, as something you do to build motivation before the real work begins. This case suggests a more expansive model. MI can function in feedback sessions, in collateral contacts, in brief parent check-ins, embedded within a child's treatment, and across an arc of months, rather than contained within a defined protocol. The spirit of MI is curiosity over confrontation, reflection over persuasion, and change talk over argument. It is a clinical posture as much as a set of techniques. The daughter's treatment would likely have stalled without parallel work with the mother. Not because the mother was obstinate, but because the maintaining environment was not yet aligned with the goals of treatment. CBT with a child whose home life continuously reinscribes the anxiogenic conditions is an uphill effort. MI with the mother was what made the hill passable. For clinicians working with children and adolescents especially, this has practical implications. Caregivers carry their own ambivalence, their own competing explanations, their own emotional investment in particular understandings of their child's difficulties. That ambivalence is not an obstacle to route around. It is material to work with. The same skills that help a client find their reasons for change can help a parent find theirs. Clinical takeaways. 1. MI is not only a pre-treatment protocol. It can be integrated across assessment, feedback, treatment, and collateral work with parents and caregivers. 2. Diagnostic feedback sessions carry emotional weight that precedes the information being shared. MI principles, reflecting, validating, and rolling with resistance, are directly applicable in this moment. Ambivalence in a caregiver or client who returns after initial disagreement is not failure. It is a workable clinical state and a meaningful opening for change. 4. 15 minutes of structured parent contact at the end of a child's session can serve as a consistent MI touchpoint without requiring a separate family therapy modality. 5. Change talk in parents articulating their own reasons for adjusting how they engage with their child's difficulties is a clinically significant event, reflecting and affirming it, rather than over-explaining or immediately building on it, allows it to consolidate. 6. When the maintaining environment is misaligned with treatment goals, MI with collateral contacts may be as important as the primary intervention itself.